Having you here is such an honor for me, and I'm so happy.
Well, it's such an honor for me, too, because you know that you were always my idol. And, like, I specifically moved on to the block where your boutique was so that I could see you walking down the street every day. And you were just such an inspiration throughout my whole life. So
that's so funny, especially having this conversation now. That's very funny. I actually remember you, and I remember that you've always been enthusiastic about fashion and about style. And exploring all the little nooks and crannies. Mm-hmm.
Obsessed. Always.
And being obsessed. So tell me why. What happened in your childhood? What was that?
It's so funny. When I was 4 years old, I came here to be a flower girl at my aunt and uncle's wedding.
Okay.
And I looked at New York and I thought, okay. I went home to Detroit and I said, okay, I'm moving to New York when I grow up and I'm going to be a fashion designer. How I got that notion, I don't know. I probably saw something on TV, right. You know, or in a movie where somebody very glamorous was draping fabric around a mannequin and going out to glamorous lunches. And I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. And then I had to figure out, okay, now how do I do it? And it was an article in Life magazine, because every kid got Life magazine
at
home.
That's right.
And it was about Fonsa Graves and Teal. And they had gone to Parsons, graduated, went to Paris, and Elizabeth Taylor opened a boutique for them. So I thought, okay, I have to go to Parsons. Mm-hmm. So where your boutique was not far from Parsons.
That's right.
So that's why I chose, it was like so strategic. I get to see Norma every day, and I get to go to Parsons.
That's so funny. So your style really has always been, you change all the time, but there's that Anna stamp on it. And so what's the first inspiration for that? What is it that's so ingrained in your DNA, in your fashion DNA, that created that?
Well, I think, again, growing up in Detroit, it's so far from London, which was happening, New York.
Yeah.
And I dreamt a lot. I saved pictures. I made this little box of like my genius files of all pictures and people and things that I just wanted to aspire to. And I think that still continues to this day. I still have that box. I mean, it's expanded now. But, you know, I always knew who was dating who. Like, who's Mick Jagger's new girlfriend and what's Anita Pallenberg wearing and, you know, just all these things. And to me, that was still like the most exciting thing. So I think if you look behind every collection, there is that outfit for Keith and Anita. There is that like thing where like it's a influence of something English or something from you or something from Betsy. You know, mm-hmm. These were all my idols.
That is so funny. When you're putting a collection together, everybody says, well, what, you know, when do you start thinking about a collection? Well, you never stop thinking
exactly.
about a collection, right? We know that it's like it's going on and on and on.
Yeah.
But what do you think for you is that spark that gets you going and that fire starts to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's the toughest thing because we have to create on schedule. And I don't know that anybody else really has to do that. So you just hope and pray that something's going to inspire you. And you're just so curious about everything. You want to look at everything so that maybe something will click and then you'll feel like, oh, this is right. But I realize now it's really a process and you have to just stay interested and keep exploring things that you really don't know that much about or you're curious about or you're obsessed with. Like all those things go into one and you can use it all in the collection. But you have to kind of monitor it so that you channel it on schedule. And that's the hard part.
Yeah.
But I think that sometimes it's really scary. You're working on a collection. You're thinking like, what am I doing? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And then somehow you have to trust what's going on and your instincts and just keep moving forward.
Yeah.
And suddenly it all starts making sense. And you make a presentation. And I think that's what brings the newness, too. But you have to get that old collection out of your system, move into the new one, and hopefully have new inspirations mixed in so that it looks fresh to you and to your customer.
Which keeps you excited, yeah. Right? I mean, I think, I don't know if there's something wrong with us.
Well, yes.
That we get excited about it. Sometimes everything you said, I could have said. It's like you're constantly curious, mm-hmm. and looking at things and going outside of your box, and then you start putting everything together and you say, what the hell is this? What am I doing? And then all of a sudden, one thing happens and it all comes together for you. Like, okay, you know, you wake up that one day, I got it. Okay, now I know what it's going to be. Or you think you have it at the beginning and then,
And it kind of drifts in another way.
So the process is so exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. It's high and low, and then when you get it, it's like, how high can you get
exactly.
from that?
Yeah.
And so it's addictive.
Yeah.
Clearly
it's so
addictive.
True. It's so true.
So I just want to jump straight to all the things that are going on with you now. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the exhibition in London, I mean, that is so seriously major. How did that come about? And
It's almost like everything else in my life. It just happened. And, you know, I went to see a Thea Porter exhibition. I never knew anything about her. I loved what she did. Mm-hmm. And by the end, I knew a lot. And I was in the bookshop buying the catalog, and the director of the museum saw me and said, oh, do you want to have coffee? And so we had coffee together. And then by the end of the conversation, she said, would you ever think of having an exhibition here? And was like, oh my God, I love this museum. Zandra Rhodes started it.
Yeah.
And they've had so many major fashion exhibitions, especially about the designers. Okay, maybe I saw a picture this big. I knew the name or I knew the outfit, but I knew nothing about what their business was like.
Right.
And so I always found it so fascinating to go there. So that was just something that I had never even thought about. You know, it's like, and especially in London. So it was such an exciting process. It took about a year and a half, 2 years almost, of just kind of conceptualizing it. Dennis Northrup, the curator there, had great concept about like how I've kind of designed in themes. Mm-hmm. And I never realized that there's so many repetitions throughout, but we grouped it that way rather than chronological. And the other thing is, you know this, you never look back, really. You're just always trying to figure out what to do to go forward.
Right.
And then to suddenly have to look at everything again, it's emotional.
Yeah.
It's just like you could, every outfit you see, the model, you see what went on backstage, and the problems, and the excitement.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
just, it's a combination of things. So it was just such a great process. Mm-hmm. And we did a book at the same time. With Abrams, and Tim Blanks wrote it. So again, that was so thought provoking because Tim came up with so many great questions about why and how and what was going on. And and all those things, again, you don't really reflect on that because you're so nervous about going forward.
Yeah. So what was your takeaway after the exhibition's up, book, you've gone through all the questions, and then you walk in and you look at it, and I mean, I don't say what will they say about you now, because I know you still are working on so many things, and I don't see you retiring in the sense of the word. You'll always evolve. But what do you think people will say about you and your career, especially when you could look at it somehow in this context?
Well, I think that one of the big problems in our industry is so many people hate fashion. Like, they're always, like, putting it down, and they're just so negative about it. And I think that I want to teach people to love it. I mean, because it's so much a part of our life. It's so much a reflection of what we're going through. And as unpolitical as I am, I see it in my work that there's times when you have to make a statement. There's things that change. There's reasons why trends happen. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things, I think, are not just fluff. I mean, it's really what's going on. But then also, I think that so many young people want to be designers. I mean, the schools are filled with design students. Where are they going to work? Mm-hmm. And do they really know what they're doing? Like, do they understand how much work it is? So I think that I wanted them to see that it's not just one project. You know, it's not just being fabulous for a second. You know, it's like, it's a career, and you need to learn your craft, and you need to evolve, and you need to be very persistent and very determined and kind of stubborn, too. I mean, you know, you can't just kind of want to be.
Right.
It's just, it doesn't work. There's too much competition, especially nowadays.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. It is a process, and the process is almost as important as any product that you produce. It's the character of the designer. It's the evolution of the designer. And I all of the points you raise, I agree with. I think my concern about fashion is, you know, we talked about I wanted to wear a hat today, but I didn't, because instead of people thinking that's fun and that I'm having a good time and I feel pretty in it, literally, they'll think, well, what's wrong with her? Like, what, you know, what's wrong with that person? And as you know, in the 70s, there were no stylists dressing people. Everybody was expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. And how expressive you were was what was so, it was like watching people creating art in the way they put themselves together. And you and I know that there is nothing more beautiful than seeing an individual tell us who they are by what they put together. And people didn't want to copy
the person, they wanted to have their own.
And here's me, and I like purple and green and blue together. So you would never want to be like somebody else, ever. You would never think they were schizophrenic. You would think, wow, what a great eye for color. Or could you imagine Jimi Hendrix with a stylist?
Exactly.
Are you joking?
Yeah.
So that freedom and that spirit was very much a part of the 70s, even up through Studio 54, which is just another kind of expression of that. But I think because today millennials have a different focus, their view of fashion is a little bit more clinical and less expressive, because their time is more about the technology and the communication rather than the creative aspect of it. Their creativity is in that. And so if you were to have a dream of what you would like people to be feeling and expressing creatively today, how do you see that?
Oh, that's a hard one. You know, I think that the potential of what's going on digitally has not been reached yet. I think it's moving the right way. I think that it's caused a lot of conformity. You know, like for instance, this is what I always think about. The kids today, they love SantaCom, you know, and where they all group together, dress up like Santa Claus, and go out drinking. But I mean, how much more conformist can you be? Santa Claus, like that's what you aspire to. So it's kind of the total opposite of what we were talking about with individualism. Mm-hmm. But I think there's creativity that happens that way, just like there's creativity in how technology has developed. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't even know where it's going to go. But when you start looking at film and what, like Beauty and the Beast, I don't know if you saw the new one. It's like the technology is so amazing. Mm. So I think that it's just going to be expressed in a different way now. And it's not, maybe it's not here, it's there. You know, it's like, it's a different thing. But I, of course, miss all that self-expression, all that creativity on how a person presents themselves. But I just think it's a different time. And it's revolutionizing how we thought, just like we did it in our time.
Yeah.
So it's going a different direction.
So how would you describe fashion now?
I think it's in a strange place. It's in a really strange place. And again, I don't know the importance of it for the next generation. I think that they like having nice things, but it's not a priority, where I would obsess and like look at every magazine I could and figure out, okay, mm-hmm. how am I going to get this? If I can't buy it, I'm going to make it. You know, it's yeah. And I don't think they think that way anymore. They just think, oh, that's cute, I'll wear it. You know, but they don't want to be too out of the ordinary.
Not at all.
It's like, I've seen other people wear this, so I can wear it.
That's right.
It's a different way of looking at it.
And pretty is, you know, I think Instagram is a great place mm-hmm. to see, better than any fashion magazine now, to see what people really are thinking is good looking or pretty. And there are so many great girls who are young, they're in their 20s, who take pretty photographs of themselves in pretty clothes. Mm-hmm. Nothing outrageous, nothing edgy,
yes.
No big prints, no bright colors, no, it's soft and pretty. And I don't really truly understand it, except that their sense of themselves being pretty mm-hmm. and their friends being pretty and all appreciating each other is sort of like growing up and wanting to be like your best girlfriends.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, where are the people who like something edgier? Like, mm-hmm. where are they? I don't see them on Instagram in the way that you see all those pretty
girls. That's so
girls.
True. That's
well,
so
like,
true.
Where you would think this would
I
be a platform.
I think they're expressing themselves in a different way. And I think that, you know, there's, on the news this weekend, it was like Comic-Con, where I see every once in a while, all of a sudden, all these comic characters walking around the street. They're doing it in a more fantasy way. Mm-hmm. I think there's those kind of like alternative lives that you can go on the internet, and people spend money and time and, you know, just develop a whole imaginative life.
Yeah.
I think it's, again, it's in a different direction. It's really out mm-hmm. there and not here and now and tangible here.
That's fascinating. I think that that's a really interesting observation. That I think things are moving so fast and everything is so stressful in everyone's lives that going into the fantasy is a safer place than being bold and making a statement about yourself where maybe not everybody is going to feel good about you, but if you're in that fantasy...
Exactly. That's like nobody else knows. It's you, only you.
Yeah.
And it's also their underground.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I have this secret life.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you've known so many musicians and fabulous people through the years, through your work, just like I have. And we're so lucky.
So lucky.
That we've had the interest and excitement and the music business for you and for me been a very close connection. Mm-hmm. So in your career, like, tell me a little bit about some of the people you've met and how they've affected you and your work.
Mm-hmm. Again, when I was a student and living next door to you, and when you rented to the New York Dolls, that was like, oh, how cool is Norma? She knows who the New York Dolls are, and they're going to be living next door.
Right.
And that's like every few weekends I would go and see them play, and they'd be wearing your clothes. And it was just like, it was just such a moment.
Right.
Which led into David Bowie.
Right.
And David Bowie showing up when they were playing at Mercer Arts Center. And then there was another idol, David Bowie. And, you know,
remember
it kind of...
Janine?
Oh, yeah. No, Hunt Janine and, was... I'll never forget Janine. Mm-hmm. Like, she was so personified your look.
Right.
But then she had the flame red hair.
Right. And she influenced Bette Midler to do her hair that way.
Oh, that's so funny, because I remember seeing Bette Midler in your shop.
That's right.
And she took Janine's pants that she was wearing because she wanted those gold lame pants. And like she needed it to perform that night. So, I mean, it was like such an exciting time.
Right.
But life was kind of like that at that moment because New York was so much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So you would see people. You would go to a boutique and you would run into someone, or you'd go to a restaurant and you would run into someone, and that would lead to something else. And it was just so much easier to connect with people without having something to tell you what was going on.
Very interesting. And I remember Central Park being such a great place to go on the weekends. Mm. I mean, we wore gowns, velvet gowns, to Central Park. And I just remember the dark purple velvet gowns and the blacks against the green grass and how beautiful that looked. And everybody would get dressed up and sort of walk around. And yes, you always saw so many people you knew because it, I don't know if it was smaller or what it was.
I think there was less people.
So, well, there definitely less people.
And then everyone kind of flocked because there wasn't that many alternatives. Like you knew if you went to Bethesda Fountain, you were going to see every cool person in great outfits.
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
It just, you knew it. And that would be Sunday afternoon, was it, or Saturday? I don't know which it was. Yeah. And then you knew if you went to Max's, you were going to see whatever
everybody,
celebrity was in town.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like there were 12 places to go. There was just the one place.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was very focused then. And you really did see everybody. And actually, it was the same in London because, as you know, I was going every weekend. Mm-hmm. And there were certain places where everybody went. And it was focused. And you got to know everybody. So tell me what else about what's going on now. What are you working on now? What's the most current?
Well, I'm doing some exciting projects. Macy's approached me to do a capsule collection for their INC collection.
Mm.
And, you know, it's funny because the first store that bought my collection was Macy's.
Really?
And that's how I got fired from my job. Because
really?
I did a little capsule collection, sold at the boutique show, and ended up getting a New York Times ad and Christmas windows. And when the owner of the company that I was working for saw that, he's like, "You have to stop." And I'm like, "I can't. I have to ship my orders."
Right.
And I got fired on the spot. So I started my own business with a $300 paycheck, you know, and it was like scary. It was very scary.
Well, you know, it's good for people to know that, especially students and people who aspire to get into the industry. I remember my early beginnings, and they were very, it was very tough. And then when Eddie and I split up, I left having $98 and thinking, this is not good.
Right.
But if that scares somebody, then they shouldn't do this.
Exactly.
Because there are lots more frightening things to come, right?
Exactly. And there's never enough money.
No.
And you always have to. I mean, I freelanced for like 7-8 years, going back and forth to Italy every 2 weeks just to support what I was doing.
Yeah.
And you just have to do what you have to do. Yeah. That's the thing.
Ultimately, if you want the freedom to be Anna or to be me, and I think if that's your goal, you don't have to be a great business person to figure out, I need to pay the rent, I need to pay these people, I need to make some money. I need to figure out a way to make some money. And it's not easy. Sometimes you think, oh my God, I mean, how many times through the years do you think they're going to close the doors on me? This is it. It's all over.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow
something happens.
You pull
something,
it off or something comes through.
Something new, something old. You know, it just, something happens.
Exactly. But it takes, you know, a strong stomach to get you through
it's
that.
It's so true.
And it also takes a burning desire to live a creative life.
Yeah.
On a level that most people don't understand. The other question I have is my boyfriend's granddaughter is 6. And I said to her, so Eloise, when you grow up and you get married and have kids, she said, I'm not getting married and I'm not having kids. And I said, really? And I certainly didn't influence her. And so she said, no, I want to write songs and I have things I want to do and I just will not have time to have a husband and kids. And so I remember somebody asking me when I was six, and I said, oh, I didn't want to get married, but they really didn't like hearing that. So I started to make up things through the years that, oh, maybe someday, or maybe I'll adopt, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I knew early on that that was not going to be for me. So did anybody ever ask you when you were six?
You know, it's funny because I always knew that this is what I wanted to do, but I never really confessed it to people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, no, you know, yes, okay, yeah, I'm going to, yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. You know, it's like right. all those things. But then I remember, like, one of my early fashion shows, my aunt was saying, you know, when are you going to get married? And then after the show, and then we had, like, kind of an event after, I said, this is like having a wedding every season. There's just as much work that goes into this as a wedding. So I don't think I ever am going to. You know, that, I think she was the first person I ever said that to.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever admitted it to anybody. But I knew, even though I got married at 19, I only got married to get out of the house because my mother was so menopausal. Mm-hmm. And you didn't just, you know, live with someone. Mm-hmm. And we were actually like, well, you met,
I remember Eddie
Molly.
Sure.
And so we were so young, and like, you know, he was a lost soul, I was a lost soul, and we got together. But by the time 10 years had gone by, I realized, you know, we really are different people, and we have different agendas. So then I knew, though, when I got married, I cried. I knew I didn't want to be married, and I cried through the whole thing at City Hall.
No.
but I think it's something that people now will say it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know what? I don't think I'm going to get married. I think I want to express myself and live a life that works for me. It doesn't necessarily always mean that that's your identity.
Well, the other thing is we came up through a time when women didn't have a lot of choices on what to do. Mm-hmm. And again, I never consciously addressed that, but it was like, I remember when I first started working in the clothing business, a lot of times I was the only woman, especially when I went to Asia and when I went to Korea. I remember working, you know, working with the factories there, going out to dinner, and I would like look around the restaurant and I'm like, how come there's no women here? Oh, they're at home.
I know.
And all the executives were men. All the salespeople were men. I mean, it was a different time.
Yeah.
And we saw it completely change, where now it seems like the majority are women in business.
Right.
So it's amazing. It's
amazing. You're right. To make that decision when we did, I mean, it was probably something we didn't talk about out loud, but subconsciously, maybe even that didn't deal with, but we knew this is okay, it's working. Plus, friendships were so different, and I'm sure you're still friends with the same people.
Yeah.
I'm still friends with the same people. Friendships were so deep because we didn't have anything between us. Mm-hmm. You really only stayed home to get a phone call from someone or to because you were going to meet them somewhere.
Right.
There wasn't anything else. Mm-hmm. But each other, or being loyal to a friend.
It's because, almost like an alternative family that you developed.
And I think that's very different now. Mm-hmm. And I think there's good and bad in that. But I was perfectly happy with my friendship. So I never felt, oh, I'm missing something. I'm like, I'm okay with this.
Yeah.
Because it's working for me.
It's so true. And plus, because we were kind of outsiders or, you know, a little bit different, we found
other
kinships
people.
With other people that could relate and got it the same way that you did, because not everybody did.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's very, very true. Mm-hmm. It's very true. So you're doing the Macy's thing, and
then I also did this great line of furniture and bedroom accessories, sheets, comforters, with Pottery Barn, which was so amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like, it was such a great group to work with, and the product, like, I can't wait to have it myself. Like, they did such
when
a great...
When is it launching?
It's launching in September.
Oh, my God. That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
What was your approach?
Well, they had seen pictures of my apartment, and I've kind of drifted sort of towards a chinoiserie look. So there's one grouping that's very chinoiserie and one that's very bohemian.
Oh,
so,
fabulous.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. How smart are they to do that with you? That really, I mean, especially for Pottery Barn, it's a great price range.
Yeah.
They really, I mean, if you need anything for your house, you can find some version of it there. But to sort of bring character and
which was
personality.
Incredible that they let me do what I wanted to do.
I think they were really smart.
Very open.
And
I think that the end result has been so exciting.
That's really fantastic. So it'll be in all the Pottery Barns?
Online and in select stores.
That's so great.
And the same with the Macy's. It's going to be mostly online, but in select stores.
And that's so much better.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
I mean, being online and to me is just the epitome of the way people really feel comfortable shopping, and you're not sort of at the mercy of a store who's having problems with their retail environment. So I think it's the safe place, and it's the place where you can reach a lot of people. You were talking about your trips to the Orient and that the male dominated. So when I started working with Japan, it was 1983, and very male dominated. Mm-hmm. They would come here looking for the man to talk to. And mm-hmm. at the time, I only had a maintenance guy. He was the only guy. And so one time, they wouldn't talk to me. So we had to get him a jacket so he could stand next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, that's how absurd it was.
Yeah.
But I loved working with Japan for so many years.
Such a great culture. The obsession with fashion there was so great.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that that's really been my big support system is Japan.
Yeah.
And out of that came the cosmetic license.
Which is so great.
And so much fun. And
the beauty of Japan especially is they don't want it to be different than mm-hmm. you are. They want it exactly
yes.
the same.
They respect that so much.
Yeah, totally.
And, yeah.
It's really fantastic. One, I remember, I don't know if you remember, but I used to do windows with wigs and
mm-hmm.
lashes, the whole thing. And it was early in my relationship with them, and they came in and they would take a million pictures, and every time we had an exhibition, they would have the mannequins exactly the same. And just before they came in, I was very upset because one of the wigs was so horrible. And I said, we've got to change that wig. It looks matted and just disgusting. And anyway, I go to Japan. Needless to say, every mannequin had that wig on it. And I thought, lesson learned. I love that they do that. However, if I don't get it right, it's not going to be pretty. So if you could change the world in any way, what would you do?
Well, I think a lot of what we've been talking about is how we miss certain things. And, you know, I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I try to show them things through my eyes because I feel that you can't just look at that. And I think that they need to put that down for a minute and just really be there and experience that and see what's around them and be in the moment rather than on this mm-hmm. thing. I think that that's such an important lesson for everyone. And, you know, I find it even with my design staff, like, you can't just look at the screen. You've got to see it in person. You've got to see how that fabric drapes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like everything in life is that way, too. You have to see it for real, not just on a screen.
Unfortunately, it's probably going to become more and more on the screen. But through Instagram, you tell your story and you connect what you do and how you do it, whether it's your makeup or vintage pictures. I mean, I think you're beating the battle by doing that and connecting people. And I think that's why people are so interested in what you do and how you're doing it. So I think that the storytelling is unfortunately one-dimensional at this point through a screen. I do think the pendulum is going to swing where the experience and the connection again. Everybody talks about we need an experiential situation. We just have to think about how to make that happen. But I do feel that history is not important to this generation because they can just Google it and have the answer, so they don't have to read about it or immerse themselves in a period unless they have a special interest in it. But I do think the storytelling in short snips is interesting, which you're doing and I'm attempting at doing too. And I think that that's really important for us to do, is to make sure that their view of today is enhanced by understanding what came before, so that it isn't just about the moment.
Exactly.
I'm talking more and more about what happens to a woman through each decade. So when you turn 20, there's a certain sort of set of circumstances. Then when you turn 30, then 40 and 50. So what were you thinking about? What was your transition at 20?
I was fearless. It was just, there was something I had to do, someone I had to meet, someplace I had to go. I did it, no matter what.
Right.
And I was fearless about consequences, or that, you know, you're not supposed to do that. You know, it's just like, I just did it.
Right.
Then as you get older, you start getting a little more cautious about things. You have certain responsibilities, and it starts changing. And then you think, like, oh, how did I do that back then? But it was, and the fact that everything was ahead of you, that was probably, like, such an exciting moment that you realized that everything was ahead of you.
You left Detroit at how old?
Out of high school. So I just turned 18.
So I think there's something about that. I think for many reasons, generations after us, current generations, are still very connected to parents, some still living with them, or very nearby, or protected by them. You left your city at a young age. I left and got married at a young age, and I too felt I was fearless, and our adventures were on the edge. I mean, we didn't know they were on the edge because we were too young and stupid, even though we thought we were so smart. And I'm wondering if that in any way has an effect on the result of a generation. You know what I mean? There was a lot. It wasn't just you and I. There were a lot of people who were, especially in New York, at a young age, doing things that were wildly creative and just like on the edge, but on the edge of some magic too. It wasn't just scary edge. It was magic.
I think it was economics at the time too. The fact that we were able to live this lifestyle, even though we didn't have a lot of money. And I think everyone around us was kind of in the same boat. Like, and then we loved vintage clothes, so we could dress like movie stars for nothing.
Right.
You know, there was just all those, it was that moment. And you could go to boutiques and clubs, and everyone didn't pay these incredible rents. I mean, like now, everything is so off the charts.
Ridiculous. You're right. It is economics.
It's become just a corporate world.
I think you're so right. I think it is so much about economics. My rent was $285 a month in that shop. And you could go to a restaurant and eat like...
I remember I would bring $5 or $10 with me because that's all I had.
No, it's true. So it is very true that you could do an awful lot for a little bit and... But of course, I was making $80 a week at the airlines, so it was all relative. And then turning 30. So turning 30 is a major turning point. And it usually starts the first, it's the first time, especially for women, that you're met with a challenge that you have to overcome. What was your 30?
I had started my business and I had to keep refinancing. And then that's when I did all the freelance work and traveled to Italy, did the styling with Stephen. It was all about work at that point. And that was my main focus, was the work. I stopped going out as much because you just couldn't anymore.
Yeah.
You had to be there in the morning and just like really. And I think that that was where I got my real discipline, was during my 30s. Mm-hmm. And realizing that I'm really sticking with this. This is what I'm going to do. Because I vacillated between wanting to be a stylist or a designer.
Right.
And I had those opportunities. And I explored it a little bit. And I thought, I don't want to work for anybody. I want to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when that set in.
Yeah, yeah. And those are big decisions. Mm-hmm. Because that then you get on a path and the consequences are going to be good or bad. And you're going to take both of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is a big deal. And then 40.
I started doing fashion shows. I think I did my first fashion show. I was, I don't know, 38, 39. And that's when that whole thing opened up. And it became a whole different level of my business. Stephen Mizell and Paul Gavacco said to me, okay, now it's your turn. And it was the most terrifying thought to do a fashion show in New York when the top designers were Versace, Chanel. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was such an unlevel playing field at that point. But it was also a moment that things were changing and New York was becoming a focus. Everyone was looking for new designers. I mean, it was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it didn't happen for me in the 80s like that, where, like, my friend Stephen Sprouse, it was happening for him. You know, it was just like, it wasn't the right moment for me. Mm. And I think that's the other thing that people have to realize. You have to be in the right moment for you.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to react when it's the right moment.
And it is so much about timing. But if you have a long career, there's the time that it is you and there's the time that it's not necessarily in your moment.
Yeah.
And it's the ability to be able to grow through both of those times and to reach out to other areas and to find out, you know, who you are in the time when other people aren't knowing who you are, thinking about who you are.
That's it's so true.
It's really, both are extremely valuable.
Yeah.
For me, I've found my biggest growth during the down times because I had more time to really take chances and risk and do things in other areas that I really love. So it's a very interesting way to kind of manage the ups and downs and the kind of the exciting and then, okay, Now I need to dig deep and explore who I am and who I want to be and what my thoughts are. We're very lucky to have creative lives. I mean, we are so fortunate. So 50.
I think that's when globalization happened. And again, being able to adapt to it. Suddenly, all my life experience kind of clicked in because, you know, get on a plane and, you know, fly to Italy and do shoes or get on a plane and go to Japan and do a personal appearance. Like, all that stuff was so easy for me. It, even though I didn't speak the language, I wasn't intimidated by the cultures. It was just kind of, I think, somehow it suited my personality.
Yeah.
And doing perfume tours, being in a different city every day. I mean, all that I found so exciting. And again, you would learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
You'd find like an hour and go to a museum and see something you've never seen before. And it would spark a whole new collection.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so again, it was using the opportunity when it happened and just really, really not taking advantage of it, but learning from it. I think that's really more what happened.
Yeah. I think the common thing women say about turning 50 is that everything they did before sort of was done, and then 50 was a whole new door opens, and it's about you, right? And many times they say, well, I don't care about what people say. This is who I am, and, you know, take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And so that freedom is really, I think, fantastic for women, and it's, and especially for women in design and in creative areas where you can really just be totally expressive. All time throughout history, who do you think is the creative spirit that you really look at?
Well, I think it's women like you, Norma. I mean, I Anna. Really have to say, no, I'm not just because I'm sitting here with you. Every time I sit with you and we talk, I learn something. You inspire me. I see what you've achieved in your life. And just what you've even said today in our conversation, you look at things in such a logical way. And it's like what you just said to me now about the different stages of life. I never really thought about it. It was such interesting questions. But I think you question all that and you think about all that, where I'm kind of just always caught up somewhere in my dream world or something. I don't know. But I think that what you're doing is so great for women and for people in general. I think everyone needs this, is to have that kind of understanding of what's going on in their life. I remember hearing that when people came for job interviews for you, you would have them write something about themselves. I mean, you were so interested in the people and who they were and how you always ask what sign you are. It's like, again, I'm not like that. And so I admire that so much in you, that you take that time and really, really, it's so important to you. And I think that the way you're able to analyze what's going on in your life, when you say the downtime, for me, that's, I'm terrified. I don't know what to do. But you take it and you create something out of it. And I think that's so amazing. And that's given me like a new way to look at things.
Well,
just in that moment when you mentioned it.
I'm honored that you say that. But I think the creative energy you have and there's almost an innocence to the spirit that you have in the creative realm. And I think that I'm so glad you're doing so much now, because I really think there's a tremendous value in young people just connecting with you, to realize that innocent creative spirit is so vital in a life, and you're like the epitome of that. And we know a lot of designers, we know a lot of people, it's a different time. Mm-hmm. And if you list the people you know that have a creative spirit, it's not the same numbers mm-hmm. that we used to know before. And I do think the world can go on and keep changing, but the creative spirit is critical to humankind, and you have that in numbers. Now, maybe we've both spent a lot of time on these things that we love, and we're, you know, a full heap of it, because we didn't have kids, and we didn't disperse our energy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, maybe that's selfish. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I can't imagine you or I living a different life. I mean, not for a minute. No regrets. I can't imagine that you have a regret about it, or I have a regret about it. Nobody can truly understand, with the good and the bad and everything else, that this, we are so blessed, and we know
so
it.
So blessed. Yeah. A fortune teller once told me, this time around, you're able to do everything you want to do.